Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are delighted to have with us now U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. His book, Making Democracy Work, A Judge's View, is out in paperback. It is rare enough that Supreme Court justices do any media interviews, so we are especially honored that Justice Breyer is with us today. Justice Breyer, thank you so much for coming on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
I love your book. And
thank
the
you.
Piece of history that I didn't realize until I read it is that when we were a new nation, there was no guarantee that the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court would even be followed. We take it for granted today that the other branches of government enforce the Constitution as interpreted by the court, whether it's Roe versus Wade or Bush versus Gore or anything else, but it wasn't always so automatic. Is that is that one of the main points that you're trying to make?
Yes, it is, absolutely. The founders expected some group of people would have the power to say when others in government went outside the very broad guidelines, borderlines, frontiers that the Constitution describes. I think Hamilton and Federalist Number 78, very interesting little pamphlet to read. He said that power should belong to the court. Why? Because he feared that if the president had the power to say when everything was or wasn't constitutional, he'd become a tyrant. He feared that if Congress had that power, it wouldn't work when a decision was unpopular. And he said, look at the document. The document gives the same rights to the least popular person in the United States as to the most popular. How can we expect Congress, experts in popularity, or they wouldn't be elected, to do something that's unpopular? Then he said that leaves the court. The court is anonymous, or pretty much so. They don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword. So they won't overreach, or at least the danger of that is smaller. Now, he didn't ask this. If this institution, the court, is so weak, no purse, no sword, almost anonymous, well, if it's so weak and it's going to decide unpopular things, why would people do what they say? I get that very question today. I get that question from African judges, from Asian judges, from Latin American judges. Why do Americans do what the court says when it could be very unpopular? And by the way, we're all human beings there, all nine of us, and we can very well be wrong. And judging from the dissents, somebody is wrong some of the time.
Yeah.
So the question's as topical today as it was 200 years ago. Why should Americans support nine unelected judges? Why? When they're going to make unpopular decisions, and indeed when some of those decisions might be wrong. And what I'm trying to do is, through history, explain how this has come about, which I think answers the why question.
And before you actually answer the why question, I'd like you, if you would, to talk about, I think, the prime example of your book, in your book, of when other arms of the government did not comply with a Supreme Court ruling, and it was a horrid, shameful piece of American history that most people don't know and certainly didn't learn in school about the Supreme Court, trying to uphold a treaty that the U.S. government signed with the Cherokee Indians in the 1830s, recognizing their sovereignty over land that they lived on in Georgia before anybody from Europe came here. Can you tell part of that story of how the state of Georgia and even the president of the United States, Andrew Jackson, defied a Supreme Court decision?
Sure. At that time, the Cherokee tribe owned northern Georgia, clear in the treaties. This is the 1830s. They had given up hunting, fishing. They were farmers. They had an alphabet. They had a constitution. They had a great leader, Chief Ross, indistinguishable from their Georgian neighbors. They had one thing the neighbors didn't have. They found gold. So the Georgians thought, why should the Indians have the gold? We should have it. And they grabbed it. Well, the Indian tribe, being very civilized, did what any civilized group would do. They hired a lawyer. Now, that lawyer was the greatest lawyer of his day. He eventually got the decision to the Supreme Court. The court eventually made its decision, said, of course the Indians are right. Of course the Cherokees own the land. And that was the decision that many have heard, because Andrew Jackson supposedly said, John Marshall, the Chief Justice, has made his decision. Now let him enforce it. And Jackson, the president, sent troops to northern Georgia, but not to enforce the decision. Rather, to drive the Cherokees out of Georgia, where they traveled along the Trail of Tears, because so many died on the way, to Oklahoma, where their descendants live to this day. Now, that was not a happy beginning. Indeed, that suggested to Marshall and the others, you know the famous question of Shakespeare, when Shakespeare has in Henry IV, you know that quote, it's a good quote, Owen Glendower, the mystic Welshman, all the Welshmen in Shakespeare are mystics, he comes in and says, I can summon demons from the vasty deep. And Hotspur, the practical Englishman, says, well, so can I. So can any man. But will they come when you do call for them? Well, it looked like nobody else was going to come when the Supreme Court made its decisions.
You do write that President Jackson came to regret defying the Supreme Court.
Yes, he did, as soon as he saw that North Carolina and some of the others said, when they looked and saw that Georgia wasn't following the court and Jackson was saying, oh, that's all fine, etc., the words to that effect, they said, well, hey, we have a good idea. If Georgia doesn't have to follow the court, why should we? Why should we pay taxes? Why should we pay customs? And at that point, Jackson realized that the Union itself was threatened, and he changed his mind. But it was a little too late for the Indians. And the Indians all did travel that Trail of Tears, and many died. Well, that was quite a long time ago. But it really wasn't, I think, until the Civil Rights Movement and the case that I think is so terribly important there. Would you like me to?
Yes, and let me just refresh our listeners who are coming in and thinking, who is this wonderful guest? It is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who has his book out in paperback now, Making Democracy Work, A Judge's View. And so, yes, you're getting to the central question, why did Americans begin to routinely comply with the decisions of 9 unelected judges deciding unpopular things?
Didn't like, right. I mean, one of my favorite cases there came a few years after Brown versus Board of Education. In 1954, the Supreme Court, simply looking around, said racially segregated schools, racial segregation in a third or so of the nation is really wrong. It deprives people of equal protection of the law. It's a nightmare. It's in effect what they said, and that's what it looked like at that time, a nightmare. The law says no state can deny any citizen equal protection of the law. Well, racial segregation, said the court, does do that. It's totally unconstitutional. That's 1954. Guess what happened in 1955? Answer, not much. Guess what happened in 56? Same answer, very little. Then in 1957, a federal judge in Little Rock said, we will have integration beginning next September. And the Little Rock Nine brave black children prepared to enter a white school. The school board was ordered to let them in, and September rolled around, and the governor Faubus, said, maybe the judge thinks they're going to enter, but I'm the governor, and I control the state police, and they're not going to enter. Well, there was chaos at that school. And a picture was taken of Elizabeth Eckford, a rather brave black girl, with a woman, white woman behind her face contorted with rage. That picture went around the world, gave a bad showing of what the United States was like. Well, after a while, the governor met with President Eisenhower, and the governor said he dressed me down like a general dresses down a lieutenant, and he told the president he would go ahead with integration. He went out and told the press the opposite. Eisenhower was pretty angry. Now, he got advice, Eisenhower, that if he sent in troops, he would have to reoccupy the entire South. He'd have to have a second Reconstruction. But he got advice from Herbert Brownell, just the opposite. You'd better do it. It's a question of the rule of law and equality in America. And Eisenhower, very quickly, over a course of a couple of days, said, I'm sending the troops, and he took the 101st Airborne. Everyone in 57 knew who they were. They were the heroes of Normandy. They'd parachuted into Normandy in World War II, got hung up on the steeples, and were shot down by the Germans. They were the heroes of the Battle of the Bulge, and he put 1,000 of those soldiers into airplanes, and he flew them to Little Rock, and the next day they walked with those black children into that white school, and that was a great day. It was a great day for the rule of law in America. It was a great day for the cause of equality. It was a great day for the United States of America.
And you're saying that the reason that Americans today so routinely accept Supreme Court decisions as the final word is that President Eisenhower was willing to use force to back one up?
I wish it were that simple. Unfortunately, I can't end the story where we just seem to end it, because a lot went on. The troops had to withdraw after a while. You couldn't keep them there forever. A segregationist school board was elected. They wanted to stop the integration, and eventually the Supreme Court told them, you cannot stop the integration. You go right ahead. You have to do it. And the day after the Supreme Court made that decision, Governor Faubus called or closed all the schools, and nobody was educated for nearly a year. And it was a long, long battle, but it could not be lost. And eventually the schools reopened. They couldn't go without the education. We had the civil rights movement. We had Martin Luther King. We had the bus boycotts. We had the Freedom Riders. We had all kinds of things in the South that eventually led to a dismantling of that legal apparatus of segregation. So my point has to be a far more complicated one and a far less certain one. And the point is, I'm a judge. And I believe those 1,000 troops made a difference. They made a difference. The die was cast. There was a Russian Air Force general once who came to the court because he'd been in charge of pointing missiles at the United States. And the State Department called up and said, they've changed the direction of the missiles. We should be nice to this man. So I sent him. They sent him to the court, and he asked me, what are your favorite decisions? And I told him about the one I just told you about, and I said, it shows the paratroopers and the judges must be friends. Now, there's something to that, but the judges cannot temper their decision to meet popular opinion. The job's to decide it as it's supposed to be decided under the law. But still, that day, when a president decided, when he decided to send those troops, I think that was an important day. I can't say it made all the difference, but for me, it was an important day, and I want people to understand how complicated that situation was and why I might think that. So when they get, you mentioned Bush v. Gore. And
you know what? Hold that thought, because we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear about that, probably one of the most fraught decisions of our lifetimes, who was going to be the president of the United States. So we will continue in just a minute with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. So you talked about the time in the 1830s with respect to Indian sovereignty, that the rest of the government defied the Supreme Court, the time in the 1950s with respect to civil rights in Little Rock, where the state of Arkansas tried to, and ultimately you get to one of the most controversial decisions of our lifetimes, Bush versus Gore, in which the Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount in December 2000, giving President Bush the election. And I guess you marvel there at what Mr. Gore did after that decision, right?
I think he said, don't trash the court. And just as interestingly enough, after the Guantanamo decisions, President Bush said, I'll follow that decision. It was against him. He said, I don't have to agree with it. And there are really 200 years of history that go behind that. What I've heard most interesting, think, I was in dissent in Bush v. Gore. So I thought it was wrong. A lot of people thought it was wrong. It was certainly unpopular. At least half the country thought, very unpopular. And I heard Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, say the following, and I agree with this completely. He said, the most remarkable of that part of that decision is very rarely remarked, despite its unpopularity. And I think he probably thinks it was wrong. I certainly did. despite all that, people did follow it. They did not throw sticks or rocks in the street. They did not shoot themselves. They did not have riots where people died. And he said, that is a treasure for this country. And I know I say this quite a lot to audiences because I want them to know about it. And I sense a lot, about 20% of you are thinking, well, too bad there weren't more riots. I said, if you're thinking that, go turn on the television set and listen and look and see what happens in countries that decide their differences in the street with guns. I see every day in my job, every day, people of every race, every religion, every point of view. And we have 300 million people in this country, and they probably have 900 million points of view. And some are very strongly held. And what I see is that they've decided to resolve their differences under law in a courtroom rather than killing each other with guns in the street. That's a miracle and a wonderful thing.
But if the grievances are serious enough and the system illegitimate enough, then even violent revolution becomes justified at some point.
That's a good theoretical point. And that's even happened sometimes in the history of the United States. But it should be kept in the realm of theory and not in the realm of practical possibility. And what is important here, and why I'm doing this, why I'm really talking to you, why I wrote this book, is we're living in a period where people are pretty cynical about the government. And some of that is justified. But if too much cynicism goes on, this democracy won't work. And the rights that are in that document won't be guaranteed. So I want to tell people, I want to do my bit, it's a small bit, towards telling people, please, teach civics in the high schools. Try to explain to the students what kind of constitution they have, what it says, how it's enforced, how they can participate in their government. That's what this is about. And just as I'll explain to the Chief Justice of Ghana, who was in my courtroom and says, why does this constitution work? She's trying to bring democracy and human rights to Ghana. Or a judge from Asia, or one from Latin America. So younger people, college students, law students, high school students, and their teachers in our own country, I think the more they know, the more they understand, it's called 12th grade civics, why and how their constitution works, the more they understand about it, the safer we are, and the more they will become committed to resolving their differences under law. And I think most people in public life feel that, and this, in a way, is my effort to make a contribution describing the institution I know, the constitutional institution, so that people can understand what we do and why, that we are imperfect human beings, as all human beings are, that we will decide unpopular things, that's part of our job, and that nonetheless, the constitutional institution needs their support. Now, that's a very complicated thought, and people are busy. They don't necessarily have time to listen to all that thought. But I'm trying to do my best here to get that point across.
People are in their cars. You have a captive audience. If I could linger on Bush v. Gore for just a second, most non-lawyers don't remember that it was decided on the technical questions of whether the state legislature, as opposed to the state courts in Florida, should get to decide whether a recount proceeds and whether different counties could do their recounts under different rules about what constitutes a valid vote. And I got the chance a few years ago to ask retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor if she came to regret her swing vote. She was the deciding vote. She elected Bush, according to many people's lights. Here's what she said.
Florida had the opportunity to recount votes and did, but it had... The court found that the Florida courts were not correctly applying federal law in the election process there. And after the decision of our court became final, there were three separate recounts of the votes in the counties that were affected by the decision. And those were conducted by members of the media. And in none of those votes would the result have changed. So, indeed, the Florida vote count was as it was, very close indeed, but it went in favor of George Bush.
I guess you never second-guessed yourself on that one.
Well, I don't know that I need to.
Sandra Day O'Connor, a couple of years ago here. What's your reaction hearing that today?
My reaction today is I'm not going, don't go into the merits of prior cases very, very, very rarely. And for my purposes, I'm just interested in the fact that there were five and there were four. And I was in the four, so I thought the decision was wrong. And I use it as an example of what Harry Reid said, and I think it's a good example of that. And but going back over all the details of the cases, I've decided is something I should stay away from because I'm still sitting there, and I will stay away from it.
Jim in Hackensack, you're on WNYC with Justice Stephen Breyer. Hello.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask about, I think, one of the most important decisions recently of the court, Citizens United, which really upheld the right of money to be given at almost any time. And to me, we're in a crisis of money influencing government. We're in the place that Roosevelt said, you know, the Roosevelt question, will finance control the government for the benefit of the few, or will the government control finance for the benefit of the many? And when we have this much money pouring in to our election process, is that not really the opposite of what Roosevelt advocated? And I'm wondering if you can say what you think the implications of Citizens United will be for our democracy.
Thank you, Jim. Justice?
No, there is a problem. As he said, can I say? He had a great question, and I can't give a satisfactory answer. And the reason is it's too recent, the case. I was in the minority. I joined John Stevens' opinion, and he wrote a long explanation of why he thought it was wrong. And the majority, which was five, wrote a long explanation of why they think it was right. It's a tension between the First Amendment and the expression of speech on the one hand. Do you interpret that to cover all campaign contributions? And if so, which ones, if so, that's the end of it. But if not, which ones can Congress regulate and how? And the four of us thought Congress can regulate this to a considerable degree, and the five thought not. And there we are. Speculation, it would be on my part as to just what the consequences are, because I'm not an expert in that. But I have to stay away from giving you a decent answer to that question.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Let me follow up on his question, and maybe you'll duck this in the same way. But
I probably will duck it. I'm almost certain to duck it. There's very little I can say about things that are really controversial.
I'm going to put it in the context of your previous book, Active Liberty, published in 2005, before Citizens United was decided. But part of your thesis in that book, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that the job of the court is not just to interpret the text of the Constitution, but to promote active participation in government by the people, by the many.
Yep.
And so I think to Jim and many other of our listeners, what Citizens United does is suppress participation by the many in favor of participation by the moneyed few.
Fine. I mean, you see, what you've done is you've read sections of my book, and I have more sections in this book, which we certainly, 90% of it, we haven't gone into. And people can read those and make up their minds what I think about something like that. But there you have it. I wrote this book in part so I could explain quickly and simply on radio or television what I believe is the importance of people understanding about the Constitution. In the books, I have far more about it, but I've learned that saying one or two words on a radio or television program can be picked up and not fully understood, so I'm pretty careful about what I say. I'm a little, I think, more elaborate and describe it a little more fully in the book.
Steve, in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Justice Breyer.
Hi.
Oftentimes when we read about one of the Supreme Court justices in the media, you're defined by the president who appointed you. And I guess the theory is that a conservative president would appoint a conservative justice and a moderate president would appoint a moderate justice. I'm wondering if there is any ever a reason or even a way to create a balance, mandate a balance between the two.
That's a very good question. And the assumption, by the way, is sometimes wrong. When I first, before I was on the court, I had been a judge in Massachusetts. I grew up in San Francisco. I found out many disagreements that I had with other judges. When I came to Washington, there was even more disagreement. I didn't even know what disagreement was till I got there. People really do think different things. Now, about presidents, well, President Teddy Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes. Within 3 months, Holmes had decided the opposite way on a big antitrust case that Roosevelt hoped for, and Roosevelt said, I could carve more a judge with more backbone out of a banana. He was furious. Judges cannot be predicted by presidents who appoint them. But at a level of general philosophy, you know, what the country is like, what law is like, how law relates to people, presidents may have more success at getting someone who shares their general philosophy. Very general, and it's going to be a kind of jurisprudential thing. Well, I've come over time to think that that's probably a good thing. Why? Because we're there for a long time. We're there for life. And over that time, different presidents will be appointed. We'll be appointing different judges. And this is a very big country. There are 308 million people, and they really do think different things. And it is not such a terrible thing if you have judges on the court who, in fact, come from different places, jurisprudentially speaking. And by the way, it's easy to overstate the disagreement. We are unanimous close to 40% of the time. We're 5-4 probably 20 to 25% of the time. It isn't always the same 5 and the same 4. And the disagreements, I think the word political is not the right word to characterize them. I think they come from different views about how law relates to people in this country and how general or how specific or how case-specific or how bright line a rule you ought to have, how much you should use history, how much you shouldn't use history, how much you should use consequences, how much you shouldn't, how much you look to purposes, how much you don't. They're pretty legal-type things, and people look to the document, the Constitution, but they sometimes find different things in that document.
And yet, I think a lot of Americans think that all those pieces of judicial philosophy, how much respect for precedent and, you know, all the things you just mentioned, mm-hmm. are used as excuses by one side or the other to justify their political positions, whether it's on abortion or campaign finance or whether Bush or Gore wins the election or whatever it may be.
I'm good for you, because I think that's the first reason I wrote this book, was really to explain the dilemma to people of supporting an institution that will make unpopular decisions, which can sometimes be wrong. The second reason I wrote it is because I know that that's just what people will say, because they get it from the newspapers. What people are doing is they're junior league politicians, and they're just really deciding their political views. Well, all my experience over 17 years tells me that's wrong. They're not junior league deciding junior league political questions with their political views. But it takes quite a while to explain that, and I won't convince everybody. But I'm trying to explain what we really do in the second half of the book, and I would describe it as more legal. It is legal in nature interpreting this document. The law is not a computer. It doesn't mean it spews out answers like a computer. Humanity and human beings are involved, both as consequences and as judges. So it's hard, and it often requires the use of values and human values. So we sometimes come to different answers, but political is the wrong word to describe it.
Take one more phone call for you. Walter in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
Yes, good morning to you, Brian, and a special good morning to Justice Stephen Breyer. Quick question is, why do you think they started the Senate confirmation hearings in the 20s instead of the early days of the Constitution? And if I could tag one more in there, where in the Constitution does it say you have to be a lawyer to be a justice, even though it's a good idea?
Justice Breyer.
The answer to the second question is nowhere. It doesn't say it. And there are those who say, why not sometimes? There have been people coming from a lot of different backgrounds. You sure you have to have a lawyer? Well, it doesn't say you have to have a lawyer, so that's up to the president.
It ever happened?
I think they've all been lawyers. They certainly haven't all been judges.
Mm-hmm.
But on the
confirmation?
And on the confirmations, it was at some point, and I can't tell you, a historian, to know why it was this point rather than that. The confirmation process is, in a sense, bringing a little democratic window of opportunity so that people have a chance to look at this person, hear them, and through their elected representatives, say whether they want them or not. Now, that's understandable compromise in a document like the Constitution that's going to send us, if confirmed, to a position where we will have power over other people, and it's very hard to remove the judges, very hard. As it should be if they're going to make unpopular decisions in favor of people who are unpopular. But this is a democratic window of opportunity. Now, I know there's a lot of criticism as to how it goes at the moment. But those who criticize it and think it's not wrong, I say, I'm not necessarily the right person to ask. I say, I was not a nominating person. I was the person who was nominated. I was the person confirmed. I didn't involve the confirming. So to ask me about that process is a little bit like asking for the recipe for chicken a la king from the point of view of the chicken. That's a good question.
And a good answer. Before you go, I'm not going to ask you to state any more positions or explanations with respect to any cases. But would you be willing to say what the most emotional, if that's the right word, case or couple of cases that you have had to decide were for the group of you? Was it, Bush versus Gore or Citizens United, which would probably be the top two for our audience? That did they stir the most passion among the nine of you?
Remember, passion, we're judges, and I've never heard a voice raised in anger in that conference room.
But it must get hotter at some time than others.
It does, but the way it's expressed is not through shouting or insulting.
But there must be some cases where you think so much is at stake more than other cases.
Yes, so what do I feel very strongly about? I felt people were feeling very strongly about Bush v. Gore, absolutely. They didn't shout at each other. And they didn't insult each other. They proceed professionally. But of course, people felt strongly about that one. If I were to choose another one, for me, it was going to be, it wasn't Citizens United, that's a very important one. It was probably the Seattle case involving affirmative action and the constitutionality of affirmative action. I felt very strongly. The way I showed I felt strongly, I did dissent. But I read my dissent for 20 minutes from the bench. That's a long time. That might have been a kind of punishment for my colleagues. But I felt strongly about that one. But there are many that we feel strongly about. And I tell the law students this. When you feel strongly, you think through your arguments, and you try, as a lawyer, to present them in a reasonable, calm way. You will not get further in winning by showing you're all emotional about it, because the other side will just say, well, we feel strongly about it too, and your emotionalism won't help. Sometimes it does, but you proceed in a rational and professional way, and that's, I think, what we do.
United States Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, his book, now out in paperback, is Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. And we so appreciate you spending so much time with us today. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Director Werner Herzog.